It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Former Attorney General Eric Holder, who, of course, served under President Obama, made some of his first comments on the full Mueller report last night in an interview with WNYC's Kai Wright here in the green space at WNYC. Some of this will be included in Kai's new podcast series called The Stakes. The Stakes is taking on big questions about social change. Episode one is out today about lead. But before you even download that first episode, some of what President Obama's attorney general had to say is being rolled out right now as Kai joins us as our first guest this morning. Thanks for coming in early after your evening event, and congratulations on the new podcast.
Thank you, and it is always a pleasure.
And let's start with a minute of Eric Holder after you asked why the Department of Justice can't prosecute people from the Trump campaign on conspiracy with Russia if they did benefit from Russia's illegal activity and knew it. Here's what he had to say.
And there's a big difference between colluding and a criminal conspiracy. If you were not a person who participated in the obtaining of the information inappropriately, if information was just out there that you made use of, I mean, it is not something that I think any campaign should be doing, because it's not the kind of thing that you would expect from a person or a campaign for the presidency. In fact, you would think that your instinctive reaction would be to go to the authorities, go to the FBI, and say, we've come into possession of this information. This is something that you all, you know, need to look at. Now, having said all that, to charge charge a campaign with criminal conspiracy, you've got to show that there was an agreement and that there was, you know, a cohesive attempt to not only to obtain but to use the information. I just don't think we're there yet.
Former Attorney General Eric Holder in the green space here at WNYC with Kai Wright last night. We have many more Holder clips to play. But Kai, it sounds like, at least based on that answer, he agrees with Mueller and William Barr, at least to that degree.
Well, he agrees with Mueller, but pointedly not William Barr. And he says Mueller did what Mueller could do. And as far as this investigation, as far as the evidence he has now, he does not have a criminal conspiracy. But he was quite pointed in saying that he does not believe that means there was no criminal conspiracy, and that he does not believe, looking at it as a prosecutor, that he doesn't think that this conversation should be over. He says that he believes that the link here to show that sort of conspiracy is going to be found in Paul Manafort, and that thus far Paul Manafort has not been willing to play. But he said, in quote, jail changes people's minds. I'm paraphrasing that, but it was something along those lines. Jail changes people's minds. And I was surprised to hear that, because in the past, after the William Barr letter came out, he just said, okay, listen, you know, we got to move on from the conspiracy thing. We should talk about obstruction, but the conspiracy thing is done. Now that he's got the full report, he's like, no, it's not done. I think there's something here with Paul Manafort.
That's so interesting. And I feel like I've been hearing similar things from some Democrats in the House, like Adam Schiff, the chair of the Intelligence Committee, who I was surprised to see yesterday say, no, we don't have the answer yet on criminal conspiracy, because there was this feeling in the land, I think, the last 2 years almost, that Robert Mueller is God. Robert Mueller knows everything, and it will all come out in the Mueller report. And Eric Holder and Adam Schiff are saying, that's not the case.
That is not the case. And I mean, you know, he pursued the evidence, and this is what in Holder's telling Mueller. And Mueller is a close friend and colleague of Eric Holder, so he respects him a lot, you know. And so he really defends the way that Mueller handled this, and says that, listen, he pushed it as far as he could. There is not evidence thus far of the conspiracy, but he said, looking at the evidence that does exist, as a prosecutor, there is way too much smoke. And what is missing is the link between all of this behavior and the coordination of the campaign. And he believes that Paul Manafort is the place where you're going to find that.
And that part is new to me. And that is so interesting that he thinks Paul Manafort is the place where you're going to find that. Because one of the excerpts from the Mueller report that I read on the air yesterday that I don't think has gotten all that much attention is some quotes of Trump to various people, like somebody representing Michael Cohen, that, you know, the boss is going to take care of you, and including to Manafort, suggesting that pardons based on loyalty rather than based on somebody deserving of a pardon under the usual standards of the Justice Department, pardons would be doled out for that loyalty. And Manafort seems to be the one who is kind of playing that game.
That is certainly where Eric Holder sits. That's certainly, I mean, I did not ask him about the pardon question exactly, but that's certainly what he is implying as well. And so he was quite clear that he's very much in line with House Democrats, and the most aggressive of them, of this investigation is not over, which is different than what he was saying prior to the actual report being out.
And I could see why he thinks Manafort might be the missing link, because Manafort was Trump's campaign chairman at the same time that Manafort was taking money or having debts canceled from a Russian oligarch or two with links to the Kremlin. And Manafort was doing favors for them, by all accounts, like changing the Republican platform to be pro-Russia on Ukraine rather than anti-Russia on Ukraine. And so there's stuff there we don't know.
Well, as our colleagues on Trump Inc. Have been reporting, you know, there are all of these things that were happening, that were clearly happening around the Trump organization and the Trump campaign in terms of pursuing both individual personal financial gain and personal and financial gain for the Trump organization, at the same time that this that the now fully established interference campaign of the Russian government was going on. And so Paul Manafort certainly was in the middle of both of those things.
And so if Eric Holder thinks that, how did he put it to you? Jail concentrates the mind.
Jail can change people's mind.
And Manafort, of course, is in prison. It makes the timeline really interesting. How quickly might Trump rush out with a pardon to prevent the story from continuing in the way that Eric Holder thinks that it might? All right, here's what Holder had to say to you, a little of it, about the obstruction of justice charge.
I think that there's the need to gather, I think, more information, and I think that impeachment ought to be, you know, on the table. I don't say that right now. I don't think that, you know, there ought to be a vote in the House of Representatives as to whether or not the president should be impeached. But I certainly think that investigations should occur. The information from the special counsel should be examined. And if that leads to impeachment, that should occur.
Were you surprised that, given the details of the obstruction case laid out in the report, that Holder is kind of that open to the question of impeachment?
I'm not. I think, it was the first I'd heard of him to say it. And he went on to say it in even more strong terms. I mean, he sort of becomes one of the more prominent Democrats alongside Kamala Harris now and Elizabeth Warren, who have said, hey, let's be really seriously thinking about this impeachment thing. And he went on last night to say, you know, that he was concerned that, you know, Democrats have spent the last 2 years railing about the Republican Party's complicity in this administration's crimes and this administration's potential crimes and not holding them accountable. And that he is concerned that now, and this is his words, that the Democratic Party is getting sheepish on its own responsibility to hold this administration accountable after those 2 years of railing in that way. So he spoke quite pointedly, the more he talked about impeachment, about how aggressive he thinks the House needs to become on this. And he did it in the friends of, you know, he said, we cannot allow politics. He named the political ramifications here are real and should be taken seriously, I believe. But he said, we cannot allow the political questions to interfere with questions about accountability, which are just fundamental to our democracy. That's his perspective. Isn't
And it's interesting coming from him and in that way, because when he says politics, I guess he means when the Republicans controlled the House, and of course they still control the Senate, just a blind defense of the president of their party, or because they think their constituents, for when they want to run for re-election, their constituents support Trump so much. From the Democrat standpoint, I guess the politics would be if they think people in America are much more concerned with what's going on in their own lives, like healthcare and lead exposure and things like that, than what's going on in Donald Trump's life, that it's actually going to make them harder, make it harder for them to beat Trump in 2020. Is that where he was going?
He didn't say all of that, but I would suspect. I mean, certainly the argument has been, and I think you have to take it seriously, is that the evidence of the 2018 midterms and the huge success that Democrats had in that was a relentless focus on healthcare and local concerns, district by district concerns. And that proved to be quite a motivator for Democrats. And so to not focus on that, if they go down the road of impeachment, that is the story between now right. and Election Day.
Accountability for its own sake versus political risk. And you asked Holder, I believe, to provide the strongest case for obstruction that he could make. Did we hear the answer in that clip that we already played, or was there something substantially more to it?
Well, he said, because he had tweeted a few days ago, that any prosecutor, and he emphasized, I capitalized the word any competent prosecutor could win an obstruction case against Donald Trump based
really?
On the evidence
really?
in Bob Mueller's report. And he said, you can read the indictment in the report. You know, what I pressed him on was because, he's defended as Mueller's handling of this, right? I mean, it's very unsatisfying, both politically and legally. You know, he has deferred to this policy, this Justice Department policy about the ability to indict a sitting president, and so he has said, I cannot reach a conclusion on obstruction, but here's all the evidence of obstruction. And that is an unsatisfying answer.
Right.
And so
because he felt his hands were tied by Barr.
By the policy that predates both Barr and Mueller, that actually is from the Obama era, that you cannot indict a sitting president. And so what Eric Holder said was that, listen, he did what he had to do. His only two choices were to reach a conclusion of no, there's no obstruction here, or to lay out the case for obstruction. So right. he has laid out the case for obstruction. And Holder says that those 10 points are a slam dunk obstruction case. You can read it as an indictment, and that the House now should pick up that case.
All those 10 points that were in the Mueller report, some of which we read on the air yesterday in rapid fire succession, like the asking of White House counsel Don McGahn to fire Mueller, right. things like that.
That's right. The quote was, you can literally read the indictment in the report.
Yes.
Although the
strongest argument that I've heard so far that a defense attorney would use in Trump's case, and I don't expect you to know this cold or know what the comeback would be necessarily, but it's that, yeah, all those instances got laid out where he asked Don McGahn to do something like that. He asked Jeff Sessions to do something like that. He asked Corey Lewandowski to do something like that, and on down the list, and nobody did it. But then Trump ultimately didn't do it himself. And he never actually did fire. He did fire Comey, but he never actually did fire Rod Rosenstein or order Rosenstein to lie and say that Trump's hands were clean, right. which Rosenstein refused to do because he wasn't going to say publicly things that he didn't believe, that were proven one way or another. And ultimately, Trump did not fire Robert Mueller and did not impede Mueller's investigation.
He did not succeed at obstruction, even if he intended to do it. He did not do it.
He didn't get others to do the work right. for him, and then when they didn't, he didn't do it himself.
So, I can't respond to it, but I think I can tell you, where Eric Holder was on this in general was to say, look, we have to back up to the basics on this. He really emphasized the actual conclusion that Robert Mueller reached, which was, I cannot say the president is not guilty of obstruction of justice.
He said he did not exonerate him.
The report. If we could say he was not guilty, we would so state. And then he didn't so state. And then he proceeded to lay out what in Holder's estimation is the case for the indictment. And so the way he puts it is that, you know, Bob Mueller had two choices in this in this report, and only two. He could either clear the president, he didn't do that, or he could describe the case for indicting the president.
And here's 15 seconds of Eric Holder with you last night, worrying that because of the various legal and political constraints, Trump will wind up, and the presidency, therefore, will wind up being above the law.
If the OLC opinion is that we cannot indict a president, and then we're going to say, well, we can't impeach this president because of political considerations, that then makes this president, as we always say, and which we always abhor, puts him above the law.
All right. So obviously many more developments to come in Congress on that. If you're just joining us, WNYC's Kai Wright is with us. His new podcast, The Stakes, dropped its first episode today, which is mostly about lead and accountability for that. And we will get to that. But he also interviewed in the Green Space last night former Attorney General Eric Holder, who will be featured on next week's edition of The Stakes, as I understand it. But Kai is rolling out some of those interview clips today. We could take a few phone calls for Kai Wright at 212-433-WNYC, the kind of odd combination of Eric Holder and lead poisoning on the table, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. So we've been talking about accountability for Trump and Holder's positions on that. You brought up the criticism of the Obama administration when he was attorney general for not prosecuting Bush administration officials for alleged crimes during the Iraq war, like torture, or Wall Street bankers during the financial crisis. And he rejected the idea that these contributed to the culture of impunity in Washington. And he also said this:
we simply did not have the capacity to bring the cases, both because of the passage of time, but probably more importantly, because the Justice Department prior to mine had issued these opinions that essentially said these enhanced interrogation techniques were consistent with American law, were consistent with international law. People acting under the guidance of those opinions out of the Justice Department, be almost impossible to get into court and then to successfully prosecute them.
Eric Holder last night in the Green Space. So many people have been frustrated with the Obama administration for landing where he landed in that clip.
Yeah. And I don't think he said anything to alleviate that frustration for those of us who believe that that they failed to hold folks accountable. And I just, you know, a lot of my conversation with Eric Holder last night was on this question of accountability, both for in the immediate with the Trump administration in the past, and on a whole host of things in our elections. It's a very important focus for us in this new podcast, in The Stakes. That's really what one of the big things we're trying to do, and why we were sitting down with him in the first place, is that as we start talking about social change, as we arrive at this place in American history where we have a not unprecedented, but certainly in my adult time, an unprecedented broth of the society that is ready to say, wait, we got a question. The way we've done this isn't working anymore, or it never worked in the first place, and we got to ask some questions about the way we put this thing together. We can't do that without also holding people accountable, holding whether it's elected officials, whether it's corporations, whether it's individual actors. We have to. We can't simply move forward without talking about what happened in the past. And that's been that has been one of the things we've had bipartisan consensus over in the last several administrations, is like, well, we're not going to deal with the crimes of the past. We're going to only move forward because that's what's politically, one could argue, is politically feasible. It's certainly what is politically easier to do. But as a society, as an American society, we so rarely take stock of the damage already done, and it has repeatedly kept us from moving forward on a whole host of issues.
And when we talk about the Trump and Russia stuff and the Trump obstruction of justice stuff, it actually distracts us from talking about other issues on the ground that are affecting Americans in their lives so much, and including, and I brought this up on the show a number of times when we talked about the Jeff Sessions administration as Attorney General following Eric Holder, and Attorney General Wright, who followed Holder in the Obama administration. We talked so much about Russia that we didn't talk about criminal justice all that much, or the media doesn't all that much. So I'm glad you went there with him last night, and I'm going to play another clip. After Ferguson, after Baltimore, after other things where there were high-profile, controversial police shootings, the Justice Department investigated, and even in cases like Ferguson and Baltimore where no police officers were convicted of anything, the Justice Department found systemic discrimination on the part of the police department, and in some cases, what they call consent decrees were entered into, where the Justice Department from Washington was overseeing local police departments to make systemic change in the direction of racial equality in enforcing the law. So Jeff Sessions comes in believing those things should not be in place. Local police departments should have their autonomy. And you asked Holder if a new attorney general in the future could reverse the damage that he sees Sessions as having done. And this is an exchange between you and him that starts with him going back to something they did in the Obama administration.
And then the president had this 21st century task force on policing that I thought was, you know, making great strides. I thought we were doing appropriate things with, you know, consent decrees. And then Sessions comes in and says that he's doing, you know, just not going to emphasize.
I mean, you couldn't have a more stark counterpoint between you and Jeff Sessions on this issue.
That would be right. New York, Alabama. Oh, my wife's from Alabama, so, you know, but... Yeah, let's just say that there's a stark contrast.
But what does that mean for the Justice Department long term? And do you look when you see what Jeff Sessions did, and now what Bob Barr is doing, and thinking particularly about the Civil Rights Division? Mm-hmm. Do you see that and say, "Wow, we did all that work, and it's just like that taken apart"? How big of a change institutionally is it?
No, there's no question that there has been a huge institutional change in emphasis. And in the way in which the department has conducted itself in areas that I would consider critical to what a Justice Department's role should be. And there has been damage that has been done. But I don't think it's lasting damage. There's another reason why this election in 2020 is an existential one. A new attorney general can come in and reverse a great many of the things that, if not all of the things, that Sessions and Barr have done.
Attorney General Holder last night with WNYC's Kai Wright in the green space. You know what jumped out at me from that answer, Kai? Mm-hmm. It was the very, very end when he talked about the possibility that a new attorney general could come in and reverse all of the things that Sessions and Barr have done. And I've been wondering, is Barr, who, you know, he's very conservative, but he comes more from a George H.W. Bush kind of conservatism, which is still very conservative, by the way, but was he sort of full Sessions on race and criminal justice and police oversight? He said the things that Sessions and Barr have done. Did Eric Holder say explicitly that Barr is on the same page as Jeff Sessions with those kinds of things?
He didn't spell it out that way, but certainly he uses, as you heard, he uses their names in tandem and sees them as having a consistent vision for the Justice Department and the Civil Rights Division in particular. And I think, and you know, that has been, I don't know if people really realize how much of a battleground the Civil Rights Division in particular is. That is the place where so much of what we understand as civil rights law is actually mitigated. So it's policing, but it's also where you deal with all kinds of bias complaints. And it's often where voting rights questions go through. And ever since, really going back to at least the beginning of the Bush administration, there has been this back and forth about how to use that division. And both the Bush administration and now the Trump administration have chosen to weaponize it to move conservative ideas, whereas it in the past it had been used to enforce the Civil Rights Act. And And what was notable about Holder's time as Attorney General is just how aggressive he was with the Civil Rights Division, you know, and the policing was probably the most visible version of that. But he really beefed it up, and so it is a very stark change. It is a very stark change that we're facing now. He says institutions can be put back together, but it is a stark change, and so we'll have to see.
Diego in Sunset Park, you're on WNYC with Kai Wright. Hi, Diego.
How you doing? Thank you for taking my call. I'm a lifelong New Yorker, and I know the Donald Trump that I'm familiar with is a carnival barker and really nothing more. But in fairness to him, he is new to politics. And I just wonder and I didn't read the Mueller report, but I just wonder, once he won the Republican nomination, was he instructed that, I mean, it doesn't seem like he would have to be, but did someone say you cannot accept help? I mean, during the campaign, this was an issue. He insisted he had nothing to do, which now obviously were blatant lies. So, like, was Don McGahn saying in the White House, this is obstruction of justice, or we're on the borderline of obstruction of justice. Was he explicitly mm-hmm. told that these things are illegal or on the verge of illegality?
Well, my reading of the sections of the Mueller report that I've read would lead to the answer basically yes to your direct question about what Don McGahn or some other people might have either said to the president. Or if not, when it comes to things like firing Mueller, if they didn't say it explicitly, they just refused to carry out his actions, which is very reminiscent of some of the things from the Nixon administration, by the way. History tells us that Nixon would thunder to do things that were really illegal, and then some of his aides would say, yes, sir, and then just not do them. And that seemed to happen in a few instances here. But with respect to the campaign, Mueller seems to have concluded that in order to charge conspiracy, you have to have done a very specific deal. Like, I will do this for you if you do that for me, and that never happened. So even if Russian interference with an American election is against the law, and Trump stands up there and says, Russia, if you're listening, go hack Hillary Clinton's emails. That's not a crime. One could argue, I guess, that it's sort of suborning foreign interference with an election and could be a crime in that respect. Mueller took it as more blah, blah, blah. Or the Donald Trump Jr. meeting in Trump Tower, where Mueller concluded that it was ignorance of the law. And so those are some of the pieces of string.
And certainly, I mean, that one of the many arguments that have come out of the Trump campaign or the Trump White House and his defenders is that, oh, we didn't know what we were doing. It was chaos. We were new at this. And so we stumbled upon it, you know. But again, I would point back to what former Attorney General Eric Holder said last night, you know, which is that, okay, fine, as far as we know, that is the case. But reading Bob Mueller's report, he does not conclude that we know all the things there are to know, and that, in fact, Paul Manafort, he believes, knows some things that might show that they did it on purpose.
WNYC's Kai Wright is here. His new podcast, The Stakes, just dropped its first episode today. It's about how we hold institutions and powerful people accountable as one of the big themes in the context of social change. The first episode is about what the podcast describes as one of the longest running public health crises in America, lead paint, which was actually banned 40 years ago. So, Kai, why is it still threatening children today?
because the lead industry was never held accountable for what it did. I mean, this is I didn't know this history when we started working on it. It's really striking. I mean, we have known that lead was poisonous since going back to the Romans, and the lead paint industry decided in the early 20th century that they didn't want us to think that anymore. And as one historian who studied this pointed out, you know, long before tobacco figured out Joe Camel, lead paint figured out how to market a dangerous product specifically to kids, and to play on racism to use it. And so they convinced us that we shouldn't be afraid of poison.
And to this point, here's just a 9-second clip from your podcast of Columbia University public health historian David Rossner.
So there's a concerted effort to kind of make this a consumer item by generally advertising it as a healthful product, a modern healthful product.
And it worked. It worked spectacularly. And by the time, and as science figured out that it wasn't, that it reminded us that, hey, by the way, it is really, this is poison, they managed to continue using these products but in our gas, in our pipes, in our on paint, by making the classic argument of, hey, well, sure, but really it only affects blacks and Puerto Ricans. It's only in those neighborhoods with this old infrastructure where we really have a problem. They explicitly said this.
They said that? And who said that those words?
People in the lead paint industry in their memos, in their internal memos, and then in their arguments to lobbying regulators to say don't step in and make us do anything about this. Don't worry about it. It has a limited impact. And so as a consequence of that, even once we finally said, okay, you can't use it anymore, they were never held accountable. No one ever said, okay, well, you did this. You made billions of dollars. Some of these companies, the same paint companies, are now $40 billion companies.
What would accountability look like?
Well, so what has been happening right now, and this is probably we picked this up recently, is that a number of states and cities, New York City is one of the places that's considering it, have begun suing these companies to say, hey, you know, you are responsible. Because the point is, there is still poison on the walls. There are still 1.2 million children in America poisoned by lead.
As we've been debating so openly with respect to NYCHA.
But you know what? This is the funny thing. It's like, it's true in NYCHA, but it's 90 some odd percent of it is in private housing. I mean, it's not just NYCHA, you know? It is everywhere. And it's very expensive and difficult to remove. And so cities and localities have not taken the step to do anything about it. Our official unspoken policy has been, we will wait until children test positive, until the child is poisoned. The child will then be the indicator of the fact we have a problem. And then we'll go in and deal with something in that specific place. And so what's happening now is there's been this movement to say, that's unacceptable. We cannot rest there.
So there are these lawsuits which will attempt to get money for this remediation from the lead paint producers themselves, arguing that they knew of the hazards when they were still foisting this upon
that's
the public
correct.
With advertising and everything.
And they did. I mean, and that's the history we lay out in the episode is for decades that they knew exactly what they were doing. They came up with strategies to lie. When those strategies didn't work, they came up with new strategies to lie. When those strategies didn't work, they started bullying Congress members and legislators. And as a consequence, all these years later, there's still 1.2 million kids poisoned of lead.
And there's a family whose story you tell in the podcast. We didn't pull any clips of the family members. Listeners, you'll just have to listen to the podcast to hear the story. But you want to give people a little preview of who you're profiling here?
Well, you know, it's a really frustrating story, and it's a good example of the harm here. You know, there's a family in New York City. We conceal their identity and don't say where because they are it's a mother and her four children, and she fled for domestic violence, turned to the city for help to get emergency housing. The city of New York placed her in housing that had lead paint on the walls. And as it was falling off and her children were eating it, one of the really horrifying details of this that we learned is that the lead in paint is sweet. And so that's why kids, once they start eating it, want to keep eating it. It tastes like sugar.
And it's just coincidentally sweet?
It's just coincidentally sweet. It's one of the things that they didn't do on purpose. But
at least that.
But it's terrifying. And so her children, their small children, are eating this paint, and they tested positive for lead. She only found out but through happenstance. She went to get them tested on the way to take them to school, for them to enroll them in school. They tested with astronomically high lead levels, which triggers an investigation by the New York City Department of Health. The Department of Health showed up. They found the lead in her house. They stamped it in the apartment that the city put her in. That lead is 2 days still on the walls of her apartment. That the city has done nothing about it.
And to this day.
To this very day. And that is the it is so enraging to me, Brian. I mean, that is the kind of thing that has happened all over this country with this story, where we just decided as a society, okay, well, you know, we'll ban it, no more. Let's move on. No one has to be held accountable. And where does that, and then who carries that weight? Who has to deal with that?
Strangely, it ties into the Eric Holder conversation you were having.
Exactly.
About whether Bush administration officials should be held responsible, or financial industry officials should be held responsible for things in the past.
That's precisely why we're starting the show with this story, is because it is, if we want to talk about social change and we want to talk about social justice, we have to talk about accountability.
So where can people hear this first episode of The Stakes?
Well, as we say, wherever you get your podcast, you can go download it right now, subscribe. You can also go to thestakespodcast.org and sign up for a newsletter where I will be holding forth every couple of weeks as we hash this out.
And episode 2 next week will feature parts of your interview last night with Eric Holder.
That's right. We'll focus in that on the conversation between me and Eric Holder about our democracy and about voting rights. Both how we got here in terms of the threat to our democracy and what he thinks we ought to be doing in order to fix it.
WNYC's Kai Wright, now host of the new podcast, The Stakes. Kai, thanks a lot. Congrats.
Thank you so much.